Every time violence flares in Israel, someone points to prophecy and says, "This is it. The end is here." But what if prophecy was never meant to scare us, but to change how we act right now? Welcome to the Journalism of Everything podcast, where curiosity meets intense research, expert interviews, and balance. I am your host, Doree Smith, a freelance journalist looking to explore all topics from immigration and vigilante justice to Ouija boards and the question of Israel. Today's episode includes part two of my interview with Bishop William Gregg. In part one, we covered whether or not Israel and the Jews are considered God's chosen people, and if they are, what does that mean for the rest of us who do not have a claim to Israel and who are not Jewish? This is particularly an important question for Palestinians who live in the region, have a legitimate claim to the land, yet are treated as outsiders and are being starved into extinction by the Israeli government. Note that I said government. That does not mean all Jewish people. In my upcoming interview with Bishop Gregg, we make references to Ezekiel 37 through 39, where a majority of Christians garner the idea that Israel is their guidepost for the end times. The end times and Israel's involvement with it is where I started down these episodes to begin with. Because every time you see Israel in the news, there's someone saying, this is it. This is the end. This is what's going to happen. Jesus is coming, or the apocalypse is coming. In doing research for these episodes, I discovered a lot about the Abrahamic religions, which are Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, and what they believe about the end times. You know what? They believe such similar things, it makes you wonder why we fight about religion and claims to the same areas where all of these religions grew and came about. We believe very similar things. So I want to cover briefly what Islam and Judaism believe about the end of the world, because with Bishop Gregg, I'm going to cover, obviously, in depth what Christianity believes. So here are some Islamic apocalyptic ideas. So if you're living in the United States, most people generally know what Christians believe about the end of the world, even though among Christians, interpretations and then the emphasis of biblical prophecy differ. While the war in Gaza continues to rage on, I would be remiss not to talk about what Islam believes about the end of the world, and then briefly what the Jewish people believe. In Islam, the apocalypse, also known as the Day of Judgment, is called Yom al-Qiyamah. This is basically the end of the world, the resurrection and judgment from God. Beliefs about the apocalypse in Islam have varied over the centuries, but we do know that from the 8th to 9th century onwards, Muslims have believed that there will be signs of an impending apocalypse. These signs have been found not necessarily in the Quran, but in the Hadith, which is a collection of sayings and actions by the Prophet Muhammad. Now, especially in the Sunni Hadith, there are sayings that refer to an appearance of the Dajjal, or Antichrist, the return of Jesus, or they call Jesus Isa, who is not divine but a revered prophet. Also, there will be the emergence of Gog and Magog, and you will hear that also in Ezekiel, the coming of the Mahdi, and then there will be natural disasters, moral decay, and political chaos. I cannot name a time in modern human history that those things have not existed. The natural disasters, the moral decay, and the political chaos, but we're always looking for that. Now, okay, so just kind of a little more on all of that. In the Hadith, Gog and Magog, who are also known as Yajuj and Majuj, are two destructive human tribes, nations, or forces that are symbols of ultimate chaos and disorder before the end of time. The Mahdi, or the guided one, is their messianic figure. So like in Christianity, that would be Jesus, the Messiah. And this messianic figure will return during the end days to restore justice, defeat evil, and prepare the world for the day of judgment, which sounds very similar to what Christians believe Jesus will also do. So the Mahdi is not the name used in the Quran, but it is prominent in both the Hadith literature and also Shia theology. Okay, so like I mentioned, like aside from Jesus returning, again, Jesus is not their Messiah, but is a revered prophet. Jesus is actually going to return and defeat Dajjal, the Antichrist. You know, Gog and Magog will come in with destruction, but they also talk more about three major landslides, a speaking beast, massive smoke that will cover the earth, and the sun rising from the west. All of these are also in the Christian Bible, either in Ezekiel or in Revelation, especially the beast is in Revelation. So there's a ton of similarities. So another aspect of the Islamic apocalypse, which is also available or also prominent, especially in Christianity, is the Day of Judgment. In that the Day of Judgment, people are going to be resurrected from their graves and they will face judgment from Allah. There is the Book of Deeds, which records every action of every person that will be presented to each person, and the good and bad deeds will be weighed on a divine scale called a mizan. Every person will be required to cross a narrow bridge over hell called the Sirat, but only the righteous will cross safely into heaven. If Islam's apocalypse is a battlefield, Judaism's just might be a rebuilding project. But don't mistake it for a peaceful fairy tale. The Jewish vision of the end times is just as vivid and just as world-changing. In Judaism, there isn't as organized of a narrative on the apocalypse, but there is a rich history of messianic writing. One concept often written or studied from Jewish writings and the Torah includes a messianic vision, similar to the idea of Jesus in Christianity and the Mahdi in Islam. The arrival of the Messiah is called the Mashiach, and it involves a human leader from the line of King David who is anointed by God. During the Messianic age, things are supposed to be grand. universal peace and justice, the gathering of Jewish exiles back into Israel, the rebuilding of the third temple in Jerusalem, restoration of the Sanhedrin, which is the like a Jewish court, and all nations should recognize the God of Israel, but converting to Judaism is not necessary, just a recognition of the God. While the Messianic age is not supposed to include any kind of cataclysmic war, according to the Jewish writings, other prophetic books like Isaiah, Joel, and Zechariah do describe a day of reckoning called Yom Adonai, or the Day of the Lord. On this day, there will be cosmic upheaval, such as a darkened sun and earthquakes, divine judgment of nations, the defeat of Israel's enemies, and a final vindication of God's people. And just like in the Bible and in the Hadith, Jewish apocalyptic writings talk about Gog and Magog, which is about as close as Judaism comes to like an end of the world battle narrative. In Ezekiel 38 and 39, especially, it talks about Gog, which is a nation or people that come from the land of Magog, which invades Israel in the final days. God will defeat these invaders with fire, hailstones, and plagues, bringing peace to the nations that recognize God's power. So many of these components are so familiar between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. It really makes me wonder, why can't we all just get along? And I know that is kind of a cliche, or sounds like a cliche. Why can't we all just get along? But there's so many similarities between these three religions in particular. At what point did we as humans look around and start thinking that we're actually different from each other? That one of us is better or more chosen than the other? That we have a right to this land over everyone else with a shared history to this land? Honestly, it's like having toddlers, but with weapons and bombs. Well, that's mine, and I will irrationally fight you over it, no matter what the consequences for anyone else. As long as I win. As long as I get my way. Between Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, we have the idea that we as humans often mess up, and somehow in the grand cosmic sphere, we must atone for our screw-ups. We have a God, whether that God is called God, the Father, or Allah, that will judge us for our screw-ups. We have a God that requires that we worship him and to constantly beg this God for forgiveness. We have the idea that one day God will swoop down and create chaos and destruction, whether that is through Gog or Magog, a beast, the Antichrist, etc. There will be natural disasters. There will be war. There will be some kind of messianic figure, whether it is Jesus, a descendant of David, or the Mahdi, which will offer us some kind of redemption if we choose to accept it. And as consequences for our actions or decisions, we will either go to hell or heaven. It's all the same. So why are we continuing to believe that we are so different from each other? Next up on the Journalism of Everything podcast is my interview with Bishop William Gregg, and this is part two. Enjoy. I went to down a very interesting rabbit hole yesterday on, usually more evangelical pastors who use Ezekiel 37 and 38, kind of like you were talking about, to talk about, well, these are the signs that this is the end times and this is exactly what's going to happen. There are other references, I know, but every time, something happens in Israel, it's that, oh, this is it. This is it. Get ready, so.
Well, the apocalyptic literature has a kind of scenario of in the Old and New Testaments where there'll be signs and things. And I think sometimes it's really pretty scary, particularly in our own day, to think about that from a biblical perspective. Are these the signs? Is the end coming? And I would say, as a bishop and theologian, well, one of the places we need to go back to is in Acts, the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 1 or 2, where Jesus was asked the question, are these the end times? When is it going to happen? And Jesus' response is, I don't know. It's not for you or me to know. That's the Father's decision, and it will happen when the Father decides. So, if there's nothing true about biblical insight and wisdom, is that it is always well seasoned with ambiguity. I would argue that. Again, the prophetic moment is about calling us into awareness about what we're doing and why we're doing it and what the consequences of doing it are, so that the call is to the opportunity to be who God has created us to be, whether we're looking at that from a Jewish perspective or a Christian perspective. That the prophetic word that the church now needs to speak is not a word so much of judgmental condemnation as it is a word of a call to, the good old-fashioned word repentance, that is to turn back, which is what repentance means. It means to turn back. And that requires us to stop a moment and look at what we're doing and why we're doing it and how we're doing it and the fruits of what we do. And to re and to ask the question, is that who God has created us to be? Is that who God has equipped us to be as human beings? And I won't taint the program with going off into specific details. I'll let your audience fill in the blanks from their
Right.
experience and thinking.
Sure.
But I think when you have so-called preachers who are sort of the fire and brimstone school of here's what's going to happen and it's happening and get ready because the rapture is coming.
Right.
Those are scare tactics that are created by human beings out of fear and anxiety. The prophets were not about creating fear and anxiety. Their job was to call us to thoughtfulness, not simply put us in a panic and scare the hell out of us.
Right. Yeah.
Because when you're called to thoughtfulness, then you're called to use your capacity to think and act in a reasonable kind of way. Am I asking the right questions? What is the question here? What is it that Israel needs? What is it that the Palestinians need? What is it that the Iranians need? And how can we figure out how to do that in a way that's consistent with God's plan as revealed in Scripture, which is a plan of life-giving, life-nurturing, life-supporting, creativity, and that issues in peaceful and not just sort of not a maudlin kind of peacefulness, but a thoughtful kind of peacefulness. There always will be tensions, but a peacefulness that allows for thoughtfulness, that allows us not to react to each other, but in ways that we can constructively collaborate together. It was an interesting thing. Queen Elizabeth II, in one of her Christmas messages several years ago, focused on the Commonwealth, which was something dear to her heart. And one of the things that she said that stuck with me was this, that the Commonwealth of Nations was not an organization designed to fix things. The Commonwealth of Nations was an organization that was designed and whose purpose was for nations to come together to learn to collaborate with one another for the good of the world.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I think, if you read Ezekiel 37, 38, 39, I think it's important to remember that chapter 37 begins with the story of the Valley of Dry Bones.
Yes.
And the prophetic message there, what God is saying there, is that God is going to restore dead Israel, will revive. The dry bones are God's people, God's beloved, the chosen.
Oh, interesting.
And the story is a symbolic representation of God's commitment to A, not abandon, B, to restore God's people to life. Life which is creative, it's generative, and it's good. And then he goes into, then Ezekiel goes into Gog of Magog and all of the apocalyptic stuff. Is, the nature of apocalyptic literature is also that it's wonderfully graphic.
That's true. I also went through some revelation yesterday, and everything has multiple eyes, and there's things with locust bodies and lamb's heads, and whoo boy.
It's, what kind of mushrooms have you been eating?
I did think that about John.
And lots of people have, but the point is to pay attention to how taut that language is. It is so taut, and Ezekiel is the same way. And Ezekiel is comparable in the sense that Ezekiel was the only prophet to write down the prophecy. He thought it was about writing it down, make a document. It wasn't just oral tradition. And so he had to use the language to try and describe something that was way bigger and more profound than human finite language is capable of dealing with. And so you get these tight, taut language, I call it, that is graphic and it's extreme and it's tense and there's nothing modest or restrained about it. But it, again, I think to focus on that is to miss the point. And the point, if you put it in the whole larger context, and remember you started with the Valley of Dry Bones, is the affirmation that God will always be committed to God's people, God will always take care of God's people, and God is always faithful. Always
Interesting.
faithful.
That gives me such warmth and hope compared to the very literal, look at that information, that language, because it is, I mean, your dry bones and the valley and all this war, and you see these things now, you see a lot of war and suffering, and so maybe it's part of just recovering from my own childhood, biblical childhood, but to hear kind of how you talk about it more thoughtfully, it definitely gives you a little more hope, in God's promises versus this really, I mean, you're right, taut is a good word for it, just very graphic and descriptive and scary. It's scary, scary language.
I mean, it would make a great horror film.
Yes,
It's got all of the necessary ingredients. But I think the thing is that we need to be careful not to take the hope and the promise and the steadfastness of God and let it become for us, oh well, everything is going to be okay.
definitely.
It'll pie in the sky by and by sort of thing. So we just sit. I mean, that's not consistent with scripture as a whole. And it's certainly not consistent with God's revelation insofar as God is not one who just sort of gives orders from wherever, but God, both in the Hebrew and the Christian understanding, is an active participant in the world for us and with us, so that what happens in the Middle East, what happens within our country, what happens in the relationships of the countries in the world is not something to be sort of passively observed. Asking the right questions is really important. Encouraging our legislators both to ask the right questions and to act on them in constructive, creative, generative ways is important. It's how human beings both respond to God's revelation and activity and do that by participating in the political life of our cities and counties and towns, our states, and our nation, so that our nation then will have people elected who are willing to ask thoughtful, correct questions that are going to promote the welfare of the world and not just the particular interests of either the politician or the administration or a particular country.
Yeah, well said. Yeah, for sure. I know it's especially living in the United States, just geographically, we're so distanced from a lot of that. It's easy to be passive, I think. It's very easy because fortunately, we're not warring, like if I lived in the Gaza Strip, I would be quite aware of this conflict, whereas, right? I live this far away, and I consume the media, and I want to know what's going on in the world, and I care what's going on in the world, but it doesn't always directly affect me. I mean, eventually it will, right?
I mean, you're 6,000 miles away. I'm 3,000 miles away from,
Right.
and so we're relatively isolated from the immediate impacts. And yet the ways that that conflict is affecting us now is not so much materially as it is psychologically, raising levels of anxiety, raising levels of fear. And those kinds of things are profoundly important to pay attention to, because the higher the level of anxiety and fear, the lower the level of functionality and thoughtfulness. So that, to be constantly creating chaos, to constantly be creating uncertainty and anxiety. And it's both fear and anxiety. There's stuff that just doesn't feel right. I can't name it specifically. And then there's stuff that's very specific. Am I going to get bombed tonight?
Right.
When I hear a whistling sound in the sky, is it heading toward me? That's a fear.
Right.
And we don't know what the price of that is long term, actually.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
we know in theory how destructive that kind of constant anxiety and fear is to a person.
Yeah, I definitely. Definitely no, you
You've
know.
had that experience, right? You've
Yeah.
been there and done that.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's lasting, you
Yeah.
know.
Yeah. I mean, there are always the folks, for example, who have PTSD. There are always triggers, and some of those triggers are known, and some of them pop up out of nowhere all of a sudden. And there you are. So those are very real impacts, though they're not the kind that you can see or touch,
Right.
but they're there. And
Yeah.
so that becomes a concern. The question I think underneath that is what do we need to do to lower the anxiety and lower the fear? What do we need to do as nations to learn to collaborate more fully? I mean, I think the theory behind the globalization of the economy is a sound theory. Because it allows economies to develop and shift around the world, but understanding that we're all part of one economic system and you make adjustments. But what we do is turn it into a means of competition
Right.
so
Yeah.
that, well, I have to have 8 cents on the dollar and I'm only 5 cents. So I'm going to put tariffs on this nation so I can get my 8 cents on the dollar. Which
Right.
creates all kinds of ancillary problems with it. And
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of thing that, to wrap back around to the Middle East, to Israel, and to prophecy is that what prophecy asks us to do, as I said before, is to ask thoughtful questions and to ask the right questions and to do so in order to design ways that are going to be constructive, creative, and generative. And to make a commitment to that's more important than any particular want that the US or Canada or Great Britain or China or India have, so that we learn to think in terms of we and us.
Right.
What can we do? And what prophecy tries to tell us, I think, is that if we ask those questions and pursue those answers, the consequences are going to be that A, we will all be taken care of. B, we will become the individuals and the nations that God is creating and expecting and equipping us to be.
Right.
However, all that said,
Yeah.
there's still the problem of sin,
Right.
which is,
Yes.
and when you link sin with
Rampant.
free will, it's not a good combination sometimes. And I think what the prophets tell us, what Jeremiah, what Isaiah, what Ezekiel are telling us is that no matter what plays out, that we're to keep on keeping on. To do the things that are necessary, to say the things that are necessary that will promote life, creativity, generativity, sustain life in the world, and we just have to keep at it. If you look at what the prophets, their relationship with God, whenever they tried to protest, which was usually some variation of, gee, thanks God, I might as well be talking to a bloody signpost. And God always brushes that aside and says, maybe so, but keep on. Here's your job. Here's what you're to do. And that's the hard part of prophecy. That's the hard part of keeping on and suffering in that keeping on out of one's integrity as an individual and out of the integrity of relationship with God. You know, the waiting for the end isn't going to be all pie in the sky and easy. But that the end will come in the best possible appropriate way by God's doing is supposed to be and should be, and I believe is sufficient for us to keep on keeping on. If this doesn't work, what might?
I like that. Because I don't know, I feel like when I was young, teenager, 13 years old, and I was baptized, and the church that I was in did a lot of altar calls, and that was sort of the purpose of every sermon. So I found myself thinking, well, I mean, obviously I'm 13, so I'm not quite thinking as a mature adult. And I just remember thinking, well, I'm set then. I'm okay. Not that I was ever a super wild person, but you know, like I'm good. I'm saved. I'm good. And I can see sometimes with that messaging, that is kind of the idea you get. Well, I'm saved. I'm good. I'm taken care of, whatever to the rest of you know. Whereas I've never thought about, you know, the talk of the end times and in the different prophecies in the Bible of that being a, hey, keep going, keep going, keep going. You know, he doesn't want you to just lay back and be like, I'm good. You know, which
There
is
was a
easy to do.
oh yeah, there was a poem that I remember learning in the sixth grade, and the refrain was, let me sit on the side of the road and be a friend to man. And you know, as in a sixth grader, oh yeah, that sounds great. As an adult, that is a really horrible poem, because if you're going to be a friend to humanity, you cannot sit on the side of the road. That is inconsistent with everything in the biblical witness, Old and New Testaments, Judaism and Christianity. God is always active, and in that revelation reveals to us how we are to be active and participating in life. And I think, you know, the other piece that comes to mind is that a lot of what we've talked about here is intentionally positive. It's intentionally encouraging. It's intentionally hopeful. And what I think religious people in the Jewish Christian traditions need to be careful of is to not let that be sort of a pie in the sky means of denying the realities of sin, of brokenness, of destruction, of hate, and all of the terrible things, war, pestilence, famine. You know, we can't deny those things. And it may be that we're not going to solve all of those things in our lifetime. But it doesn't give us an excuse not to try anyway. That much of what comes to us through the traditions of Judaism and Christianity, much of what comes to us through the scriptures, is in a really serious way aspirational, in the sense that it holds up to us the best possibility and calls us to it. And God promises to equip us for rising to the occasion. And I think that aspirational dimension is really, really important. Because if we lose sight of the vision of our best self, whether it's individually or as states, as nation, as church, as synagogue, if we lose that, we lose our direction, we lose our way, we fall off the rails because we don't have a vision of where we're going and therefore why we do what we do here now, the way we do it. And I think that's critically important, especially for a country that prides itself on the separation of church and state. And in a larger world where the state is a secular institution by design and choice. France, for example, is very strongly that way. I mean, even more so than the US. It was illustrated when the coronation of King Charles III was sort of anachronistic in the sense of why would you do the coronation of the head of state in the context of the Holy Eucharist, which is the liturgical setting of that whole event, is the Mass.
It is.
And the first meal that the newly crowned king takes is the body and blood of Christ.
Interesting.
So there are lots of things that don't fit easily together anymore that maybe once upon a time did. So that raises questions for us. You know, maybe the country is more secular than religious, but for the religious person, what does that mean? How does the religious person nonetheless respond to the fact of wars and violence and natural disasters and famines and all of these kinds of things? Why do I, as a Christian person, or why does one, as a Jewish person, care about forming organizations to try to get aid to people, get food? We'll get medical equipment to people. Why do we work to protect the rights of vulnerable people? And it may be that the social contract is, well, because that's good for the society. You know, you take care of me, I'll take care of you. Scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. We'll get along fine. But for a Jewish person, I think that the grounding has to do with knowing who they are in relationship to God, as God's chosen people, as instruments of God's work. Well, what is God's work? And how do I, as a Jew, participate in that? Or as a Christian, why I do that is because of, at least in my tradition in the Episcopal Church, that's how I live out my baptismal vows. To seek and serve Christ in all persons, to honor all people, to respect the dignity of every human being, to strive for peace and justice, and to speak that as prophetic word by word and action in the present, and to understand that the way forward, the way toward those aspirations, is to live my baptismal vow or to live in the covenant relationship if I'm Jewish. And if I don't do that, what scripture and history tell us is it all blows up.
That's true. That's very true. Wow, this has been so great. I can't tell you. I was thinking about this on Sunday, and I'm like, I don't want to bring it up on Sunday because I want to talk to him later without interruption about what's going on. And these are all questions I've had just myself.
Yeah.
Also growing up in both a Southern Baptist, but also in an Episcopal tradition. So, I've had lots of education from different ways, but I
Yeah.
appreciate you very much. I know it's a little later there than it is here, so I appreciate you coming on my podcast. And when it's out, I will let you know, probably next week sometime.
Well, it was my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for talking about the end of the world with me.
Okay.
Prophecy's real job isn't to tell us when the world ends. It's to push us to keep going, even when it feels impossible. And that might be the only way forward for Israel, Palestine, and the rest of us watching. So now that we have discussed Ezekiel's prophecy according to the Bible, I wanted to tell a story that I stole from ChatGPT. I asked ChatGPT to retell me Ezekiel 38 and 39 with Israel being the aggressor. And I want to note, I know that Israel is not the initial aggressor in this war. I understand that, and I've covered that before. But they are being the aggressor now. So I thought the result of this story by ChatGPT was pretty brilliant. So here it is, a retelling of Ezekiel 38 and 39 by ChatGPT. What if modern day Israel is Gog? Title: The Fire from the South. A modern prophetic retelling of Ezekiel 38 and 39. Son of man, set your face against Gog. But this time, Gog doesn't come from the north. This time, Gog wears a Star of David. In the latter days of a fractured world, where nations play politics with ancient grudges, there rises a military superpower from a strip of land known more for its prophecies than its peace. Once a people surrounded by enemies, Israel has become strong, technologically, economically, and militarily. Its drones fly unseen, its missiles strike with precision, its borders are sealed and electrified. To the south, Gaza lies in ruin, a cage of concrete and rubble, its people weary from decades of blockade, uprisings, and retaliations. Yet even in suffering, resistance smolders. For every ceasefire, there is a flare-up. For every truce, a whisper of revenge. And then a moment comes. An attack. Horrific. Televised. Chaotic. Israel calls it casus belli. The war drums begin. The operation is swift and merciless. Columns of tanks. Squadrons of jets, the thunder of bombs falling day and night. The world watches as the death toll rises. Civilians buried in the rubble, families fleeing with nowhere to run, entire neighborhoods turn to ash. Gog invades, or has Gog become us? In Ezekiel's day, Gog was a distant tyrant, a symbol of evil marching toward God's people. But now the roles blur. What happens when God's chosen people become Gog? When the invading force no longer comes from a foreign land, but from within the covenant? The prophets cry out beneath the headlines. Some whisper, "This is justice." Others scream, "This is genocide." The nations argue, but do nothing. Some send weapons, others send thoughts and prayers. Yet the blood soaks the ground all the same. The fire falls, but who is consumed? Then comes a reckoning, not of fire from heaven, but from global conscience. Mass protests erupt. Leaked footage floods the internet. Former allies recoil in horror. The land that once stood as a moral symbol now faces investigation, condemnation, and internal collapse. Not because it was attacked, but because it became the attacker. I will turn around and drag you out, says the Lord. I will bring you to judgment, not for being conquered, but for forgetting mercy. In the ruins, both north and south, the children look up and ask, who was Gog? And none can answer without trembling. When I think about what is happening in Israel and in Gaza right now, I just feel terror, sadness, and confusion. While on the surface, this might not be purely a war over religion, at least in how different ethnicities identify with religion, is a factor. Religion is important to a majority of the world, certainly. But how many wars have been started because of religion? I would say almost all of them. There have been religious wars to convert others, to overtake others, to seize power for different faiths, etc. And I'm not going to say we should get rid of religion. Absolutely not. That would be unreasonable, impractical, and terrible. But what if we didn't let religion dictate our political actions? What if our religious beliefs didn't fool us into believing that we are better than others because of them? The United States has supported Israel, I believe, at the core, because the U.S. identifies as a Christian nation, and the Jews are God's chosen people, if you take the Bible literally. Right now, then, the U.S. is supporting Israel, even though Israel is literally starving out Palestinian children in Gaza. Israel has bombed hospitals, schools, and even food handout points. Was Israel initially attacked by Hamas? Yes, for this war, absolutely. And it was terrible. But Israel's response, if you ask me, has been more terrible. And the Israeli government feels justified in their actions because they are chosen, because they are considered more important than the millions of Muslims living in Gaza. Why is anti-Semitism such a terrible thing and Islamophobia isn't? I am not a religious person, though I used to be. But part of why I am not anymore is this kind of weaponization of religion. Why would I want to follow a religion that is hurt, that is used to hurt and destroy others who do not believe what I do or weren't born where I was or raised how I was? That just doesn't seem right to me. And when I see starving children in Gaza who are Palestinian, no matter who started it, that will never be right to me. If you've enjoyed peeling back the layers on Israel and prophecy, this is just one of the many stories that we unpack on the Journalism of Everything podcast, from the politics of immigration to the psychology of birth order, from the science behind Ouija boards to the realities of vigilante justice. We go wherever curiosity takes us. So if you're the kind of person who still asks questions long after the headlines fade, subscribe and join me for the next conversation. You can find the podcast on all the major podcast apps, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. If you want to see a video version of the podcast, please subscribe to my YouTube channel.